Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You scared of things that go boom, boom, boom?
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric, and gunshots by computer, Michael Kester.
Okay.
That's what I have this time. That's what I have for you.
Really?
Yeah. Let's get this out of the way right away.
Uh-huh.
The year one companion for today's episode.
Uh-huh.
By which I mean the two movies that have nothing to do with these two movies, but...
Okay.
What we were up to a while back...
Yep.
...was something that I believe has only happened twice on the show, which is when we did a sort of mini-series kind of... We did a 45-minute movie that's not really a movie.
Okay.
I can only remember twice, but this time we did North Fork and Dr. Horrible's Sing-Along Blog.
Oh my God.
Our show was longer than Dr. Horrible's Sing-Along Blog. I find that kind of humorous.
Yep.
So if you want to get that, it's on Apple Music. It's on Amazon. It looks like people are actually streaming that, which is cool.
Huh.
Those shows are super weird and early, and I would use the word fascinating to describe them. I don't know if you remember anything from that year, but it was fascinating.
Now I remember certain things from that year. I don't remember North Fork at all, so I can't
I was gonna
even
say,
remember what a conversation about North Fork would have been like.
People in suits, it was like the 1920s or something. I don't know.
Yeah, someone had wings in that movie.
What are we doing this time on the show?
This time we're going to cover Happy Accidents, and then we're going to cover K-Pax. It's kind of a, what is the truth? What is reality?
What the fuck is going on, Double Feature?
And where is this guy from, Double Feature?
Where is this guy from, Double Feature? I like that.
Yeah.
I like that a lot. I want to thank Rebecca Maxwell right away for bringing Happy Accidents to us.
Yeah.
And fuck it, we're just going to start talking about this right now. Skip to 24 minutes into the show. If you don't want to spoil Happy Accidents, which, by the way, you don't want to do, watch Happy Accidents first. You will be, it's such a good movie. You'll be so pleasantly surprised.
I know, right?
It's really just wonderful. You will feel so good. And then we're going to talk about K-Pax 24 minutes in. So I guess that was the first thing I wanted to talk about in Happy Accidents is that it might surprise people, but I enjoyed the fuck out of this movie.
Yeah. No, it's, I felt the same way. I was not. So here, let me put this in a little story. So as many people who listen to Double Feature know, I sometimes go physical film hunting.
Uh-huh.
And I knew we were doing Happy Accidents on the show. And at one of my physical film hunting haunts, I found Happy Accidents on digital video disc.
Mm-hmm.
I
don't even have a device that would play one of those. Did you know that?
No.
There is nothing in my home. I have 7 computers. None of them have DVD slots.
Wow.
You're watching movies on a floppy, my friend.
So I looked at the cover and immediately thought, oh God, this is definitely not a film I plan on permanently acquiring.
Uh-huh.
And so I put it back down.
Oh, mistake.
But it cost me, you know, $5. Yeah, and that's where the story ends, is I went and watched it and I thought to myself, that is totally a film I ought to have acquired.
Mm.
It is, for all intents and purposes, and it is no misnomer that the movie's called Happy Accidents. It's going to surprise you in a lot of ways. So for me, another thing is Vince D'Onofrio is always somebody I expect to do a good job.
Yeah.
Maybe not. He's never the first person that comes to mind when I think of great actors, but I always have high expectations for his performance, even in a movie like The Judge.
Oh yeah, that's right. You do get paid residuals for talking about The Judge. I forgot.
Yeah.
It's been a while. You must be trying to get that $5 back to go buy Happy Accidents.
I know. I'm trying to earn it.
See, I didn't know. I've been watching Vince D'Onofrio for years, and I just didn't know until Daredevil, and then
really,
I mean, he's my favorite part of Daredevil.
The cell didn't tip you off?
Well, you know, in all of these movies that I've seen him in, look at the stuff we've done on the show. There's The Cell. He played fucking Orson Welles and Ed Wood.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's kind of, I don't want to say he's always disguised. We saw him in The 13th Floor. you know?
Right.
He just has so much range to him.
Right.
Look
that
at
you lose him in the roles.
Look at just Daredevil, The Cell, and Happy Accidents.
Yeah.
Those are three totally different actors.
I feel like Vince D'Onofrio is the kind of actor who in movies you go, Vince D'Onofrio was in such and such a film, and you sit there and go, who is Vince D'Onofrio in that?
Yeah.
And you're going through and you're going, well, that was Jack Nicholson. That was, you know, such and such. And finally you get to, oh my God, that was Vince D'Onofrio.
Yeah.
I can picture it. It's totally Vince D'Onofrio, but I had lost the actor in the role.
Well, the character that he plays here is so fucking batty that to see him, I mean, it's just not somebody I would have picked for this role.
No.
And I think that's almost true every time I see him in something.
Yes.
Which is why I'm not casting movies, I guess, because, you know, who would have known? But yeah, it's just stellar and hits it out of the park every time.
Well, and it's a hard role because it's a hard movie.
Mm-hmm.
There's this undertone to the movie where it gives the audience a lot of credit to figure out the what's and whys of his character's behavior.
Yeah, yeah.
For example, they never flat out say, man, this guy's really into weird 50s music, or why is he dressed like that? Because the idea is that he is from so far in the future that he's trying to pinpoint a decade within somewhere within a century. He's going,
I wasn't even thinking about that with the music, but it's the exact same thing. He thinks this is the music of the time.
Right. He's trying to land in the ballpark. He's trying to, you know, he's threading a needle in a windstorm.
Yeah.
Going, all right, well, I've got this range of time. I'm not exactly sure what the difference was between the 1950s and the 1990s.
Right, right.
It couldn't have been that much.
Well, it's also up to Marissa Tomei's character to find him weird. This might be bad, but I don't think his first date is that weird.
Really?
The fact that he shows up, she's dressed up, and she goes, oh, I thought we were going out. I mean, that's the moment where I go, no, I brought you this tape of Cannibal Holocaust. So to me, it's just, that's every day.
Well, that's the thing though. And here's kind of where this starts ringing true, is that it's not weird now in 2015. But in 1999, it was weird to have a record player.
Yeah.
It's not now, but then, you know, busting out vinyl and so retro is now in such a place where it's in a vogue that makes it almost approaching normal.
Right.
In the year 2000, man, we were afraid of computers. Yeah. We are not in a place where retro's okay.
Yeah. Well, I think the other thing is it's not terribly crazy to go along with this. And that's a piece that I really love, is the suspension of disbelief. It's such an outlandish thing, but at the same time, what could be, you know, you will accept the outlandishness of From the Future because that's what the movie's about, right? It's accepting that superheroes are in a superhero film.
Right.
But there is an opportunity for detriment, for you to look at this and go, but why would this woman ever stay with this guy? Why wouldn't she just bail right away?
Right.
And I think they tackle that so well too. They talk about the exes. You get to see inside her head a bit. You understand this idea of, well, she's playing along, and it's like two people of different religious views should totally separate them. It's very important. It's what happens after you die or not.
Mm-hmm.
But they just don't talk about it so they can be together.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's kind of how this is.
Right.
It's sort of like, well, you got that weird space-time thing, but let's just let that go. I have fun.
Sure. Ultimately, they're the same species, I think, is possibly what's going on.
Well, and they talk about the culture too. It's a little bit, maybe not metaphorical, but it's further down the line. It's like an extended metaphor almost. Talking about Jewish culture and at the same time mocking religion, which is interesting to me. You know, that moment where they go, do you believe in Christ as your savior? And then everybody laughs.
Yeah.
And they start doing these sort of reverse religious litmus tests, walking by a church and going, do you have any desire to go in here? Oh, phew. And it's interesting because it's not, you know, it's not in 2015 where everybody under the age of 25 doesn't believe in God.
Right.
It's just that from their culture, this is sort of the non-religious Jewish,
right?
Sort of the atheist cultural Jew. And I think to see them arrive at what reasons they're having for not being able to see these people or the problems they've had, you know, in the past, and then compare that to what they're going through now. I mean, to think about somebody who's from the future, it's almost like a cult. It's akin to the same weird religious problem. And the other things too. I mean, I love when they show the fetishist.
Yeah.
And he just puts his hand up. He has the glove on it. The aura guy cracks me up. I mean, there are all of these little character quirks that also feed into why would she do this? Mm-hmm. Look at the people she's surrounded by. The other, it reminds me in Secretary of the tomato throwing guy. The guy is chained to a radiator, likes tomatoes thrown at him.
Yeah.
There's just so many whack jobs that she sort of feels, yeah, well, this one's not that weird, I guess.
Yeah.
It's a total romantic comedy thing. It's like a, they came together thing.
Well, yeah. And that's a lot of where this movie pretends to play.
Yeah.
Similar to They Came Together, but it's on a different plane because it's not being facetious and it's not being satirical, but it's kind of going, what if a romantic comedy, except he's from the future.
And playing it so sincerely to the point, not to say it knows it's really funny and is a total straight man, but it has created a brilliant romantic comedy by doing this.
Yeah.
Which I just didn't expect at all.
Sure.
I can't express how blown away I am that I'm going, wow, this, you know, the best movie I've seen in a month, it's this romantic comedy. Let me tell you about it.
Yeah.
It's just so unexpected to me. And that I would have so much to say about it. You know what I mean?
Right. Well, it's definitely a movie that when you're watching it, there's kind of a split for me, because I'm sitting there going, I kind of don't want this to succeed because it seems like a dumb premise.
Yeah, sure.
And then there's another part of me that's going, I want this to succeed so I'm not wasting my time. And well, this could be really good.
You say dumb in shorthand, but I would say a unlikely to succeed.
Yeah.
Premise.
Right.
Yeah, you go, there's no way this is going to work.
Right. And they wind up so hard at the beginning that when they get toward the end, the payoffs, they start dancing around these pitfalls of what could just waste the movie. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. It's not careful. It's very deliberate. There's different stuff where you realize, basically when they start approaching the points where they're going to need explanation and exposition, specifically into the time travel aspect of the film.
Yeah.
And they come up with really creative ways to do that while still leaving things ambiguous.
Yeah.
Other time travelers whose careers are odd for a time traveler.
Yeah. right.
Or, you know, looks into the perspective of the time traveler without necessarily ever expressly saying this is reality versus this is perceived reality.
Well, and you get these hints that are kind of hamster style-esque things all through the movie.
Right.
And I mean, maybe because I was just so blown away by it in the first place, but I didn't call any of them. I wasn't going, oh yeah, that phone number, that's because she's going to call it later. Oh yeah, the 3-letter, 4-letter thing, that's going to become important, which right. I mean, should be such obvious that's coming back. Why else would they talk about it? Mm-hmm. But because the crazy pours on so fast, the movie has such a charm to it, this sort of natural quirkiness that doesn't seem written or forced at all.
Right.
It just seems like, here's some weirdos.
Yeah, it seems like a symptom of just the bottle that they're putting everything in.
Yeah, you can't do this with other people. These are the people who would be involved in this.
Right.
And I don't know that I've ever seen a film I would describe as quirky and also completely genuine. You know, it's a hard thing to do, and it's why I used the word warm to describe the movie. You know, it's it makes me like it very early on.
Right.
I like that it pours on the crazy. I like that we start the movie and it's already nutty. And I actually had wanted to talk about that right away, and then the movie progressed and it got crazier. I was watching this thinking, oh, so they laid out all the crazy 5 minutes into the movie. That's an interesting approach. Mm-hmm. And then it just kept going.
Right.
Which is awesome. They unravel this sort of, it's a mystery almost.
Yeah.
You know, it's a figure out what's real here and whether the question of is it real or not, I feel like a little bit in both of these movies today, is sort of a side question.
Yeah.
If you know the answer, then rewatching the movie is still good.
Yeah.
It's not as if the whole thing is a question of what's going to happen.
Well, I also feel like in films like this where they're intentionally leaving a certain layer of ambiguity, you tend to get to the end and the film always shows, it tips the scale just ever so slightly in one direction mm-hmm. or another. And in yeah. Happy Accidents, and we'll talk about how this works in K-Pax too, but in Happy Accidents, it's the kind of movie where once the movie's over, two people can go, oh yeah, okay, so they did tip the scale. And they'll have a different idea of which direction the scale was tipped.
Yeah, I was wondering about that.
And then you go back and rewatch the movie, I would imagine. And I think, because, and I'm saying this mostly as somebody who's seen K-Pax a few times, but it's the kind of thing where you go back and rewatch the movie and you find evidence against your theory way more often than you find evidence to promote your theory.
I think there's a little more of that in K-Pax than there is in... I feel like both of these movies by the end reach kind of a definitive point.
Do you?
I mean, in here I feel like it is the therapist scene that solidifies what's going on. If we had been presented that strictly from one character's point of view, mm-hmm. then I feel like we could just be looking at the crazy
yeah.
from their eyes.
But you don't...
But because it's such an objective kind of scene with these two characters talking and you're a fly on the wall.
Yeah.
I do feel like we're seeing behind the door of the secret meeting.
But
the
you
secret
don't...
meeting that tells you where the film is.
You don't suppose that it's the therapist playing therapist, right? That didn't occur to you?
No, it didn't.
Yeah, that's what I was saying when I said that the other time traveler has a dubious job.
Yeah.
Because all of a sudden he's alone with a therapist and she goes, oh yeah, I'm a time traveler too. Tell me about your time travel.
Yeah, so I guess, wow, no, I did not consider yeah. that at all. That's brilliant. I guess what that would come down to is rewatching the scene and trying to pick out which pieces of information, although yeah. any of it could have been
yeah, that's
told to her by Marissa Tomei's yeah. character, right?
It's very, very interesting. That they
wow, used. I did not think about that at all.
Right. Well, and I mean, I didn't think about it until the next movie because you get another therapist. But
oh, sure. wow. Awesome double feature.
The notion of this therapist sitting down and going, yeah, no, I'm totally a time traveler. I'm from a different sure. time too. So, and it, you know, it's just a, that's what I'm saying about exposition. It's a fascinating way to expose his time traveling. From a way that he feels like he can let his guard down.
Yeah.
Which just could very easily further enforce his insanity.
Right.
Because if she goes, I'm a time traveler, and he goes, what? That's, oh, yeah, no, me too. But instead, he's just vindicated by the fact that there's a second time traveler, like he's always theorized.
I didn't think this was possible, but you've actually made me more excited to watch this again.
Yeah, right?
I was pretty sure I was already right there. And it's one of those rare movies that I finished and went, can we watch that again?
Yeah,
can
same. I felt the same way.
Can we just turn around and see that again? But yeah, because we get the therapy flashbacks, it's a sort of device that lets you know anything that we've seen in the movie could technically be stuff that she is telling her therapist.
Right.
And as she starts to discover these pieces and they start feeding you what's going on, which I think is awesome, the big critical piece she says is when she finds the, there's that great scene where I go, oh no, she found the notebook from Spiral and she's turning to the page to look at the drawing.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's actually the same fucking notebook. So I laughed really hard at that, but she looks at these fucking psychotic sketches, right? I mean, they are really psychotic. And when you look at them, I don't see how you could reach any other conclusion than the one she has reached.
Right.
So it's another great push and pull moment. And then his explanation, I mean, they tell you that about the character. You just kind of want to believe him. He's a charismatic guy. And you don't need to tell that to the audience, because I think as an audience member, you believe him and he's a charismatic guy.
Right, right.
You know, when we're away from him, I go, he's nuts.
Uh-huh.
And then when we're with him, I go, no, he could be from the future.
Yeah.
That's probable. You were talking earlier about dancing around the science fiction elements and the time elements.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I thought about Looper a lot during the diner scene.
Yeah.
Which is such a fitting, you know, to try and go, let's just sort of sidestep this. We know we have to do it and we can't do it at the same time.
Yeah.
And first of all, I just thought it's really strange that there's two diner time travel scenes in recent double feature. But I think this has to be one of the best. I think I said the same thing about Looper, but it's one of the best explanations of sci-fi, because that's so secondary.
Right.
Because it gives you something to focus on. You know, they're doing a gag while they do it, and it's a sexy gag at the same time. So nobody's paying attention to time folding back in on itself, which, by the way, is also a pretty good excuse for how this would work.
Sure.
So it's got all its bases covered. The movie is really, it's a really smart film.
It is.
It's something you talk about every so often. It's smarter than it needs to be,
mm-hmm.
than it even deserves to be.
Yeah.
I would have accepted something that tried way less hard.
And another thing that this movie, we already mentioned it, but one of the things that I think this movie does better than even a lot of the movies that we give credit for doing this,
mm-hmm.
is it doesn't underestimate the audience.
Yeah.
It's a film for people who are on board. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a movie where if within the first 10 minutes you go, I don't think I like this, it's not for you.
Sure.
It's not trying to win people over.
Right, right.
It's a movie that comes in and knows what it's doing, and it's very deliberate with each of the steps and how all the things unravel and how all the characters fit with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of lets the audience just get it or not.
Yeah.
As opposed to trying to spoon feed things that would cheapen the whole picture.
Sure. Well, it's not afraid to be itself. It's not afraid to go out there and do some pretty complicated things, not even as far as plot or, I keep using the word sci-fi,
mm-hmm.
not as far as those mechanics, but even just the relationships are complex. Their relationship is complex. I love the scene with her mom talking about missing her husband being an alcoholic. That something was lost by doing that. It's first of all an unpopular viewpoint that nobody wants to promote, but is something that's, you know, probably true, at least in this relationship. And it's just a fascinating character thing. It's a fascinating thing to sit down and go, you know, this was going one way. It was bad. We knew it was bad. We changed something. And as a result of changing that thing, it's better, but some of it's really not better.
Right.
Of course, being, you know, another metaphor for what's happening in the film. And the ending too, which before it becomes happy, I think is genuinely sad.
Yeah.
And kind of heavy too.
Sure.
The sort of countdown clock to you're going to die.
Right.
This isn't a romantic comedy.
Mm-hmm.
K-Pax is a movie that does not star Paul Hewson.
It does star Paul Hewson's glasses, though.
You know, it's funny. I've seen the cover of K-Pax so many fucking times. And every time I'm like, why is Paul Hewson in this movie? The fuck is? I didn't even know it was Kevin Spacey, which
really?
Is one thing, which is one thing. But then on top of that, to just keep walking by and go, Paul Hewson, what the fuck is this? The sort of like world tour video or something.
Yeah.
And then you said you want to do K-Pax. I'm like, oh, this is because we haven't made a Paul Hewson joke in like 5 years. That's mm-hmm. clearly
right.
why this is. And then you mentioned Kevin Spacey.
Right.
And I still didn't put it together. I'm like, Kevin Spacey is in a movie with Paul Hewson? But there's no Paul Hewson. It's just right. Kevin Spacey.
There is another musician who has but we'll talk about him in a minute. K-Pax is a movie that I saw long time ago after it came out, but still a long time ago.
That's usually when you see movies, is after they come out. Rarely do you see them before.
Well, but I mean, not theatrically, but later. And I remember watching it and going, huh, that might have been okay. And then never revisiting it.
Ooh.
And it's always one of those movies. We have these movies. I don't know if we mention them directly on the show, but we have these movies that kind of end up in double feature schedule limbo, which are movies that neither of us have strong feelings towards, but we know they exist and we know what they're about. And they're kind of...
And there was a tinge of, I think there's something to that.
Right. They're basically movies that definitely have lens flare. That's what that genre of film is. Okay. Is cold movies that have lens flare. And we go, is that a thing? Is that right. movie a thing?
You were too blinded by the movie. You right. couldn't see if it should go in double feature or not.
And K-Pax has kind of tumbled around in schedule limbo for years.
Yeah, it has. Yeah.
And we finally found a perfect spot with Happy Accidents.
Can we just talk for a minute about that too, that pair?
Yes, yes.
I mean, it wound up, I don't remember how it went in the schedule. When that happens and I don't know how it's there, it's usually you.
I think that's right.
Or I just keep giving you credit for things I've forgotten about, one or the other. So it's one of those. Let's just credit Rebecca Maxwell for it.
Yeah,
that seems like a good thing to do. But the tone is, I mean, that would be a reason. If I had sat down and just watched this movie, just out of the blue, if I wasn't in exactly the right mood, I would have hated it.
Right.
I would have thought it was corny or hokey or, you know, whatever. It's such a hard tone for us because I feel like I go into every movie expecting it to be some kind of Tarantino Cronenberg thing.
Yep.
And if it's not, if it deviates from that at all, I'm like, well, that was not what I expected.
Well, there's definitely, and it's terrible as somebody who records a podcast about movies, but there's this thing where I watch a movie and there's always a point where I go, this is a normal movie.
No, I know exactly what you're saying.
And it's funny because 95% of the films I've seen in my life are not, quote, what I would call normal movies.
Yeah, yeah.
But when I say normal movie, I think what I mean is accessible, you know, something that the general public might not thumbs down on Rotten Tomatoes.
Right. It doesn't spray you in the eyes with mace as you watch it.
Yeah.
What is wrong with us?
It's terrible. But
but by putting it with Happy Accidents, you basically say, because you could have the same problem with Happy Accidents. You could have it even with the double feature, whichever one you watch first, trying to ease you into that. But by doing a double feature of two movies that are tonally around the same area, I mean, you could put up a wall, but you would look like the idiot. You're outnumbered.
Right.
Now there's two movies and one of you. And if you just watch the one movie and you go, well, that was silly. But by there being two of them, it kind of makes it okay. It normalizes it. It goes, you know, there's probably a lot of movies like this. Some people like this. Why are you having a bad time? Take the fucking chip off your shoulder. Just enjoy movies.
Right.
They gang up on you and you just have to give in.
Well, and for me, it's as easy as seeing David Patrick Kelly in the lens flare-y credits where I go, there's something for me.
Yeah.
And it's funny because I like Jeff Bridges. I love Kevin Spacey, but they're so famous that they'll be in stuff that I'm not crazy about. David Patrick Kelly is the perfect climate of character actor.
That's weird, isn't it?
Only shows up in stuff that I like.
Yeah.
Whether it's The Warriors, The Crow, Penn and Teller Get Killed, doesn't matter. If David Patrick Kelly pops in and says anything, there's something about it that appeals to me. And if that's not enough, Saul Williams helps.
Yeah, sure.
Although it's really off-putting to see him in a meek role.
Oh, I didn't think about that. I felt like, you know, that character I was always looking at going, what's this guy's deal? How does he play in? Where's the spot for him? He does carry a lot of sort of gravity to him.
Yeah.
It feels like he's going to become, you know, an A player by the third act.
Sure.
And yeah, to see him, I guess I had that same reaction to see him in sort of a sidelined role. was a little strange, even though I don't know that I've ever seen him in a movie before.
No, I've never seen him in a movie, but I've read interviews, you know, listened to his music.
Saul Williams was during the, that was my awakening to him. I think yours was probably the same, but during the Year Zero era of Nine Inch Nails.
Right, right.
So he'd played a couple of shows with them on the tour, but also did Survivalism.
Mm-hmm.
And then had the record, The Rise and Liberation.
Inevitable,
right?
Inevitable Rise.
The Inevitable Rise.
Rise and Liberation.
Was Liberation in there?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, The Inevitable Rise and Liberation of Niggy Tardust. And Trent Reznor did all the production and I guess basically all the music for it.
Right.
So that was kind of my introduction.
And the backup vocals on the Paul Hewson song. Boom, yeah. Did it.
That was my introduction in a lot of ways to, hey, hip hop's a thing you should care about. And that was around the same time with LP and Vientology. And it just never stopped from there. And I always knew he acted, but I don't know why. I'd just never seen anything he was in.
Well, K-Pax isn't a movie you go to. That's the thing. It took me 10 years to revisit it.
Right.
And it's revisiting it. I honestly just didn't remember the movie. I think I remembered him eating the banana pretty much most vividly.
Right.
And
I think you're thinking of Class of 1999. Wasn't right. that the
yeah.
yeah, Stacey Keach eats a banana.
Yeah. We should do a weird eats banana double feature.
Well, there should be a list of that somewhere.
That's double feature show at iCloud.com.
The thing that brought me on board with this was Kevin Spacey's character shows up and is immediately arrested.
Mm-hmm.
Just starts right off, you know, because that's where you kind of think it's going.
Yeah.
It's got a little bit of a brother from another planet kind of vibe mm-hmm. to it.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going, well, how does a person, you know, you don't know what his deal is at first, but even in retrospect, you're going, he's not going to know how to do stuff on this planet.
Right.
So, you know, he's going to get in trouble eventually. They don't waste any time on that.
Right.
They're like, boom, arrested. You're going to this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're watching Virgin Suicides the rest of the time.
Yeah.
Or I guess One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is the one you want. It's not the one I want. I'm going to stick with my Virgin Suicides on that. But yeah, I already love it. And I think the movie takes those sharp turns every now and then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have this crazy patient. I know, I'll invite him to my 4th of July barbecue.
Mm-hmm.
These things that are just so nonsensical, but it does tell you, one, that the movie's willing to just, hey, this is interesting over here. Just immediately, we don't need to take a nice round turn to that. We can just straight line to that point.
Yeah.
And also you start to see the extent of the madness that the character's going through, that Jeff Bridges' character is going through to try and crack the case, basically.
Well, it's definitely a look into how insanity is contagious.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things that the movie kind of touches on, is the idea of sticking a bunch of crazy people in a room together doesn't make anyone saner.
Yeah.
And they toy with that because obviously...
Is this going... I see a path to a prison reform conversation. Yeah, is that where you're fishing?
Definitely not.
That's not where you're going with this?
But they toy with that because Prote, you know, is attempting to actually cure the patients.
Yeah.
Using magic medicine bag type right. energy crystal bullshit.
Magic bluebirds.
Yeah. But the thing for me that I always remember the most about K-Pax other than the fruit... is the ending.
Uh-huh.
And I want to talk about it early because there's a lot to say.
Sure.
So similar to the other movie in the double feature, Happy Accidents, there's an ambiguity to what's really going on. And so the idea is that Kevin Spacey plays an alien named Prote who's come down here to do some unfinished business for about 5 years, and then he's going back to K-Pax.
That's his story anyways.
Right.
My story is the movie is worth the price of admission to see Kevin Spacey bark at a dog alone.
Yeah.
Right there. That's all it. Or talk to a dog. I don't know which is funnier. The idea that he's trying to talk to the dog or just barking at it. But yeah, that's his story. We don't necessarily know that that's the story.
Sure. And then through hypnosis, it turns out that he's somehow connected to a missing person who may or may not have committed suicide after finding his wife and daughter raped and murdered respectively, but also at the same time.
Another one of those great, hey, let's introduce a super fucking heavy moment.
Into right, this. Which also happened exactly 5 years to the day, to the time that Prode is going back to K-Pax. Oh good, a countdown clock. Let's see if the alien disappears.
Such a good double feature.
So the movie ends in a really interesting place where Kevin Spacey, let's just say Kevin Spacey.
You don't want to keep saying Prode.
Robert Porter, Kevin Spacey, Prode. Well, because it's ambiguous.
Yeah.
Kevin Spacey is playing a vegetative person.
At the end, you mean?
At the end.
And before the super bleak end monologue.
Right.
The universe is expanding and collapsing, so never make a single mistake. And good night.
Mm-hmm.
What a fucking awful soul crushing.
So all the other people in the psych ward insist that that's not Prode.
Immediately. Who is that guy?
Right. I mean, immediately.
Yeah.
The people who work there, Jeff Bridges included, see Kevin Spacey, which is the same actor that played Prote, and go, that's the same guy.
Uh-huh.
It'd be like if, you know, you saw Lex Luthor and Prote in a room. You'd go, that's the same guy.
Right. Yeah.
And the movie kind of drops off at that point. So I know it's stupid to just flat out ask you, but I think I want to have a dialogue. What do you think? Do you think Prote was taking over this dude's body and zipped back up to K-Pax?
That's exactly. Yep.
That's where you are.
But this is the part where you're going to give me the alternate one and I'm going to go, oh, damn.
Well, I mean, there's the multiple personalities thing, right? Where Prote was invented as a defense mechanism because every time he came to help the boy was whenever the boy needed a defense mechanism.
Yeah, sure.
And so he finally interns himself into this psych ward by no accident because he's gone 4.5 years without that happening and reaches this psychiatrist whom he already knew about when he first met him. He's researched this psychiatrist specifically.
Yeah.
And when the psychiatrist has a breakthrough, the alien disappears. And now there's just a man.
Uh-huh.
So.
Well, and the other thing is Kevin Spacey is so convincing when he's having the moment
in hypnosis.
We were just talking about this with Hitchcock, the convincing performance versus the telling performance.
Right.
Where you feel like, well, what the fuck is he talking about if he is Prote?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? If there's not a person trapped inside there.
Right.
And are we to believe that, I mean, Prote makes the joke about the fastest, quickest draw, whatever thing.
Yeah.
If we are to believe he's being genuine, crazy or not, crazy or space alien or whatever, it suggests that he does not know what happened while he was under hypnosis.
Right.
Which either means that hypnosis puts him to sleep and brings the other guy out of a coma, or that he's just a dude. He's just a mild-mannered earthling.
Well, and what seems to be the nail in the coffin for this is definitely an alien is that one of the patients goes missing at the end after he says he can only take one, right?
Mm-hmm.
However, here we go.
Oh.
However, Prote has gone missing for 3 days, which indicates that he does know a way out of the ward.
Yeah.
And nobody else knows it. So all he's got to do is go, so when I left 3 days ago, what I did.
Take the back door. They never lock it. I don't know why.
Tell it to this lady.
Uh-huh.
And she makes her way out.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the thing that nails it for me is the
post-credit sequence,
the space montage.
Yeah.
Is there a post-credit sequence to this?
Yes.
Fuck you. No, there's not.
There is.
You've watched more of this movie than I have.
Yeah.
Well, I'd ask you, but let's assume everybody else is. I'm not going to ask you to describe what happens in part of this movie I haven't seen. So I'm going to go do that. No, I was going to say the montage of space stuff.
Okay.
Where they're, you know, flying through a.
Okay. I mean, you know, space is still there.
Yeah, they're just like, hey, let's look at outer space for a while. We're just going to zoom around here for a bit. The drawing on the light diagram, which is a hell of a scene.
It is.
I mean, it's really a fabulous scene. For him to have that kind of knowledge I was trying to keep in mind that things in movies are theatrical. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, you wouldn't expect that the mild-mannered Earthling has this superior knowledge, but also they could just be saying that he's pretty fucking smart and maybe he was an astronomer at some point or something to that effect.
Well, there's the he could be a savant, which is further supported by the fact that he and his friend used to get away from their terrible lives by looking at the stars for hours.
Yeah, actually, there's a lot more. I thought this one was a lot more cut and dry than...
Yeah.
You are running circles around me today.
It's
I'm just like, whatever movie, tell me whatever you want.
Well, and so here's the thing is I want so badly for the definitive answer to be Protus from K-Pax and he took over some dude's body.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I want the answer to be.
It's what you feel in your heart of hearts.
No, it's not. That's the problem.
Sure.
Is that I want this to be a sci-fi movie, not a psychological drama.
I think either way, it's the
same film and it's a great film, but the reason, and this is kind of what I was saying back in the Happy Accidents chapter here, I want so badly for this to be a story about an alien that I spent the entire time watching this movie looking for a way to explain it's not an alien.
Oh, sure.
Because if I had gotten to the end of the movie and found something that I couldn't explain away,
sure,
I would be very happy.
Yeah, right.
But for the same reason I watched all of Aziz Ansari's fucking Master of None, just so I could argue all the points other people are making, I was watching this tearing apart every single piece of evidence that this guy's an alien.
Yeah, it swings back and forth really well. It gets you right to a point and then has this counter evidence that's great. And I think that's a good way to watch it, is to be playing devil's advocate all the time.
Right.
When really I'm just following along like a fucking bonehead, just going, well, I don't know. What does Jeff Bridges think? Let's ask him.
Right.
He's the expert. I'm just some guy.
Right. But Jeff Bridges is losing it too.
Yeah. Right. Right. If he was an alien, the thing that would make me love that is it would give me a kind of excuse for a problem I've always had in film, which is that aliens look like people.
Sure.
They're always carbon-based humanoids.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, I understand why it is that way in film, but it's almost definitely not that way in life. Mm-hmm. It would be even crazier than aliens having already visited the planet. The fact that they have arms and legs and breathe oxygen. You know what I mean? It's it wouldn't be like that at all. They would have evolved to their environment. They may not even have evolution in the same sense that, you know, we imagine it.
Well, there was that semi-discovery that may or may not have turned out to be real. I'm not going to say whether this happened, but it did open something to my understanding that I hadn't considered. A while ago, there was reports of them having found life, small microbial life, in, I want to say it's a lake or a crater in California, but the life was cyanide-based and not carbon-based, and that's why it had taken so long to find it.
Oh, interesting.
Which opened my eyes to the idea that life may not even be made of the same material.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, it could have followed a completely different trajectory. So that would have been a problem, but then, again, just explains it away. Goes, if you're from another planet, why do you look exactly like us? He goes, well, obviously that's the most efficient thing.
Yeah.
Because I'm on your planet.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, why did no one else ever say that? That's perfect.
Right.
You don't get to see what we look like on the other planet, but as soon as our silver door opens on the spaceship, we grow arms and legs.
Right.
It's just what happens.
Well, and one of the other strongest points too for that whole scene is when the psychiatrist says, well, on our planet, a fella named Einstein claims that nothing could ever go faster than the speed of light. And then instead of laughing that off or just immediately going to tachyon theory, Prout goes, no, I think what Einstein meant was.
Yeah, right.
Which is a really good way of going, I know your planet's history. I know what you guys believe.
You just dropped an emotional anvil on my head. Look at me, I'm a pancake. We have a website. It's doublefeatureshow.fm. Doublefeature.fm. I don't know what our website is.
Yeah, just drop the show. Fuck the show.
It's doublefeature.fm. And what was that email address?
I believe the email address is doublefeatureshow@icloud.com. Please send us photo images proving that your film is about eating a banana in a funny way.
Yeah, but you could send us pictures of you eating bananas. That'd be great.
Humorously eating bananas. I don't want any boring, obvious banana eating.
I can't handle you. I want to thank Brianna Kruger, Rod Fielder, Seth Hanasek, Enrique, David Koch, and Lee Napolitano. And I also wanted to tell you about something. I've been sitting on this for fucking ever. And then the announcement was made. So I guess it's well past time where I can talk about this. So I had mentioned 31 going to Sundance.
Mm-hmm.
Director's cut is opening Slam Dance.
That's funny.
Isn't that
that's
crazy?
Crazy. Yeah, that's awesome.
Both of these movies are opening. It's in Utah, by the way. I had to actually look this up. damn you. Now I can't, you know, now I can't wait on it. But Slam Dance is sort of the counterculture Sundance, sort of the anti-Sundance or whatever.
Right.
They take place at about the same time in the same place. And Director's Cut is going to open up the first day. It's like a special event showing to open the festival. And then 31 is, I believe, the midnight showing, the special midnight showing. So both festivals are going, this movie's insane. And we're going to throw it right at you right in the beginning, which is fucking awesome. I don't even know what's happening right now. I don't even, I can't deal with reality. What are we doing next time?
We are going to do a Jungle Hazards double feature, a Fish Out of Water and Things Keep Getting Worse double feature, a movie about interesting people making movies double feature. So we've got Sorcerer, which is a movie that's about a group of guys who try to get out of their shitty third world life by driving trucks full of nitroglycerin across the jungle, something we've never covered on Double Feature before.
So it's the 1970 something, 77 Sorcerer.
Right.
Not the German Sorcerer.
Correct.
Or the New Zealand film Sorcerer.
No.
The one that came out in Brooklyn last year, it was a small showing.
No, it's the one with Roy Scheider.
It's not the one you did called Sorcerer, the screenplay you wrote for Sorcerer.
No.
Not the Sorcerer video from America's Funniest Home Videos.
Also not that.
Okay. I think we got the right one.
Okay. And then we're pairing that with Romancing the Stone, which is a movie that has Kathleen Turner. And that's really all you need to know to go see that movie. Because
definitely something we've never covered before on the show.
Definitely.
Let's fix that next time.
Yeah. And it's directed by Robert Zemeckis. So I guess what? I don't know. Watch more fucking film.
All right. Bye.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.
Yeah, no, it's, I felt the same way. I was not, sorry.
I told her not to make noise.
I was not, so here, let me put this in a little story. So, as many people who listen to Double Feature know, I sometimes go physical film hunting. So I,
Sheila. Please tell me you're crawling on the floor.
You're fine. Just, you know, make it quick. It's fine.
Oh, my God. Sorry, what were you saying?
Sorry,
can't get over that.
So I looked at the cover.